I'm going to take us back into Poland in 1939, and I'm here today to sort of make a plea to everyone in the audience who might be inclined to follow a trail that to this point has kind of led us to many dead ends. Siege, Julian Bryant's most famous film, was released in 1940 as a short film in the RKO Realism series, and it was then nominated for an Academy Award in 1941 in the shorts category. The importance of Siege lies mostly in the fact that Bryant was the last Western cinematographer left in Warsaw when the German strafing began in early September 1939, and as such, he was able to capture the first glimpses of the Siege of Warsaw, and these were the first images that made it back to the West, and they're also the first images that capture the actual official beginning of World War II. Bryan had just spent the entire summer in peaceful pastoral Switzerland working on a travelogue film and lecturing, and he, at the end of August, had a lot of footage, a lot of film stock left, and decided the best thing to do would be to head further southeast. So there, off he went on a train, and by the beginning of September, he was traveling east, traveling from the east via train back through Romania when news of the activity in Poland reached him. It was too late to turn the train back, and he proceeded, and he could sense that whatever was happening at that point was definitely something significant. So I'm not going to continue on with too many details of what of the footage that you're going to see shortly, a 16-millimeter print that we have of this film, Siege. I want to instead kind of shift the story to our search for original 35-millimeter material on this cut show. Our desire to locate as much of this original 35 cut show as possible came about after a series of discussions with folks at the Academy Film Archive. I don't know if Snowden's in the audience this morning or not, but there's working with Ed Carter, who's the documentary curator there. Basically, one of the missions of the Academy is to try to preserve as many of the Oscar-nominated films as possible, and Siege is indeed one of these films, nominated again in the Best Short Subjects category because in 1941 there was no Best Documentary category. USHMM, at this point, the Holocaust Museum, holds all of the 35-millimeter existing outtakes from this film. We've got camera negatives, some fine-grained master, and also some positive prints. But Bryan shot so much footage in Warsaw in 1939 that didn't make it into Siege. The actual finished cut film is only about 10 minutes long. We don't have any of this camera negative, actually, that made it into the completed show because that was in the hands of RKO. There are several 16-millimeter composite prints that are in circulation. Two of those are at the Holocaust Museum as well as a dupe neg, and you'll be seeing one of those prints in a few minutes. They're obviously prints struck from the reduction dupe neg. So at some point when these 16-millimeter prints were struck, there did exist somewhere 35-millimeter material. Bryan himself used the 16 prints and circulated them for many years through his International Film Foundation. When we acquired these prints in 2003, we also went kind of searching around to find out other archives that also had this material. The Library of Congress had a 16-millimeter print that was donated by Julian Bryan himself back in the 60s. Sam has a few copies in his personal collection, and we've since located several other 16-millimeter prints in circulation and one that screened as recently as last year in Chicago at the newly created Chicago Film Archives. It's a curious but not really shocking fact that this completed show of Siege is for all intents and purposes lost. It's curious because nearly the entire Bryan collection has remained relatively intact and survives to this day intact. It's floated to several different storage facilities throughout the northeastern U.S. There are some material that Bryan himself donated to the library, as I said, in the 60s, some material that he also donated to the Polish archives and the Polish government in the 50s and even earlier in the 40s. But for the most part, this collection has never really been divided and it's remained in the hands of Sam Bryan until we at the Holocaust Museum took some of that footage in 2003. The most obvious reason we can really kind of come up with for this, the fact that this reel is missing, is that he did it for hire under the auspices of RKO, and the RKO library has been sold and divided many times over. The trail has had some interesting twists and turns, and I think it's worth relaying this to all of you because it serves as a sort of case study that demonstrates just what sort of machinations archivists and researchers engage in order to kind of locate materials. Even with the support of the intricate network of extremely knowledgeable and accommodating archival colleagues, the whereabouts of this film in 35 millimeter still are unknown. We followed a number of leads over the past few years, and we began by determining whether the three other archives that we know for certain house a significant amount of Bryan materials might have something hidden or forgotten in their vaults. The Imperial War Museum in London was one of these places, WFDIF in Warsaw, Poland was another, and the Library of Congress was the third. No luck at any of these locations. We then began by trying to track down RKO materials with the help of Ed Carter at the Academy, with Dan Strebel's help here, Mike Michon at the library, and Chuck Wilf at UCSB. We learned that RKO shorts were sold off long before Turner acquired any of the RKO library. Leeds had led us to Madison, Wisconsin, and to MoMA, who apparently had some of the RKO shorts, and again back to the Library of Congress, that apparently acquired a significant amount of RKO material in the 1970s. And all of these leads, again, brought us down the same road to nowhere. But we weren't really satisfied with this final word, so we called in some other markers and began speaking to people at Warner Brothers, and we called on David Shepard as well, who I think is somewhere out there in the crowd today. And he can confirm this if he is here, that it's believed that a good portion of the RKO Shorts library ended up dumped in the Hudson River. Again, not very encouraging information. But we still plodded along, and Dan was able to find out that through his trail of searching for RKO Shorts, that the RKO Shorts library was at one point sold to CNC TV and then sold to an entity known as Marion B. Incorporated. Marion B. Incorporated rights were then sold to a gentleman named Eric Saltzman, who's now a lawyer and teaches at Harvard Law School and continues to control the rights to the Marion B. films. We contacted him, and he agreed to cooperate with this project if we ever do manage to find any of this material, but he actually has no knowledge of where the actual film materials that he purchased the rights to might actually be. So consequently, neither do we. We're stuck at this point right now. It's a little bit of an impasse. This is where the trail has taken us this far. We certainly haven't exhausted all possible routes. In fact, Sam just reminded me yesterday that his father, I think Julian himself, took the prints to Argentina, or they were shipped to Argentina. There were 35mm prints of Siege that were circulating in Argentina not long after it was shot. So there's a possibility that there may be something lingering in South America that we haven't gotten our hands on yet. So as you sit back and watch this print of Siege, it's a 16mm print, not the best quality, not the most visually arresting material that Brian has shot. In fact, a lot of the outtakes for this work in Poland in 1939 are actually more striking than what made it into the finished film, but I'll reserve any more comments so that you guys can look at this yourself. But if anything comes to mind, you can think of any other ways that we can start to, or that we can continue this hunt, that would be great. Please feel free to holler out, let us know in any way that you can.
Well, we are running short of time. Could you start the next 35mm roll, please? And when I get to the section on Poland, you are invited to shout out questions if you want to, because otherwise we're just going to roll film until 10:30 and see where we stop. We're going to start out in the Caucasus in the early 30s. With Julian Bryan sitting with some locals and exchanging pieces of paper, exchanging phrases to communicate. He, as I said earlier, always made an extraordinarily close connection with people wherever he was, whether he could speak the language, and I don't believe he spoke any Russian, maybe a few words. I did a long telephone interview in 1987 with Robert Spencer Carr, who was one of the cameramen who accompanied him, including, I believe, on this, certainly for, I believe, five successive years, or several years in Russia. Carr was in his 20s and living in the Soviet Union with his Russian wife. And we're watching men creating footwear out of grass and, I guess, bits of leather. Carr told me that he was the one who arranged the mules and for these ventures in which the Ivy League students came along, and he referred to them as forced labor. He said they had no idea what they were getting into, but... And he said that they took along a minimum of 10,000 feet of 35mm negative, IMO cameras, and he emphasized that Julian liked the utmost simplicity, minimum equipment, hated gadgets. That fits with what Russ was telling us about how he would film interiors. And Carr described Brian's approach to photographing native peoples as winning their confidence, letting them look through the cameras. Sometimes they were in places no foreigner had ever been, including, for instance, Svanetia, a place that absolutely fascinates me from what I've seen of the footage. These student groups, Carr described as laid back, friendly, harmless, girls sometimes disguised as boys, and he recounted a conversation Brian had with a local shepherd asking, "Are you abducting these girls or married to them?" Are you going to sell them when you go down from the mountains? You must be of great importance to have so many women in your seraglio. And Brian said, no, I'm just a hardware merchant in a small town. I don't even own any sheep. And the shepherd said, how sad. We're now in Moscow, experimental theater. Brian filmed a great deal of interesting cultural events, and this is a Jewish theater scene. It's one of the things I'm very anxious to see preserved, the rare scenes he did capture, including of Mikoel's, in the Moscow Yiddish Theater, who played King Lear in Yiddish that we have in our exhibition. This is Russ's most recent work. Pardon? I don't, not yet. Somewhere I have notes on what the other one was. And now we're going to see Poland, the Country and the People, another edited film that did have a commentary, although we're seeing it silent. This is what we have. But I wanted you to see the credits and have a chance to glimpse some of the interesting collaborators that Julian Bryan worked with consistently. One of them, yes, it would be interesting. Jules Bucher was a major cameraman, companion of Bryan's. Yes, Merce Cunningham, if we had heard it, and Philip Stapp, great animator, who you can find out more about on Jeff Alexander's website. So we're looking at a cut, a couple of sections of the cut film. I apologize for the wobbles, which is embedded in this element. I've included some industrial scenes here in keeping with our theme. And I'm going to share with you some notes that were transcribed from an audio recording of Julian Bryan, Jules Bucher, and Robert Spencer Carr screening their Polish footage. And I believe this is in the early 70s that they had the screening and conversation. And among the things they said, the three of us had just come from the Soviet Union. We had worked there for several summers. To work for a month or two in Poland was a real contrast and something of a culture shock. Carr said that in the summer of 37, food in Poland was abundant and cheap, which was a real contrast. The production... I'm blanking on the production year, but it's filmed in 36, 37.
And released like this probably 10 years later.
Okay, Sam says released maybe 10 years later in this form. He would have given the film lectures, which he did at Carnegie Hall, Town Hall, as well as libraries and universities. And these were really renowned lectures. Now, isn't it beautiful? It is so beautiful. I'm telling you, this is the same reel from which you saw the VHS material. No, I'm jumping the gun here. That probably was, but this is, of course, edited, and in a minute you'll see the other. Sure.
The Julian Bryan footage of the degenerate art in color.
Yes, and not in color.
It wasn't color.
Black and white. You're going to get a glimpse of it here, maybe, if it's before 10:30.
Yeah, which is amazing footage.
The only footage of the degenerate art exhibit, yes. He was hauled up before the committee. And Sam knows the story, and which I don't really. Go ahead.
Well, he did end up in front of the great junior senator from Wisconsin in the 50s. Well, this is interrupting you.
No, you can come up. It's okay.
Joe McCarthy was very interested in the fact that my father had been to the Soviet Union so many times, and using some of the adjectives and words that Russ and others have used, was a humanitarian and maybe cared about people. Not, McCarthy didn't seem to. And he went with his lawyer, I think maybe twice, to Senate hearing rooms and was asked to show and demanded that he show the films that were being labeled communist propaganda by McCarthy, one of them being Peoples of the Soviet Union, which was on the program today and which we didn't see, and was shown in the, one of the Senate hearing rooms, or part of it, McCarthy dashing in and out, apparently, to the Senate floor for votes and not spending an awful lot of time watching. A second film was one Philip Stapp, who did these maps and little pieces here called Boundary Lines, which was a 10-minute animated thing about Brotherhood of Man and so on. McCarthy took one look at that and said, it's nothing but a cartoon. I don't want to see that. And I guess my father, in a sense, got off. He did demand full answers from the committee as to why he'd been called to Washington and to get a transcript of the hearing. That might be available now, but it was not in his lifetime ever something he was allowed to read.
And Robert Spencer Carr was also called up. He, however, was an avowed communist follower. I mean, he was keen. And I don't know what the result of his appearance before the committee was. But now we're going to until we took clips from it. This is Krakow. 1936, the railway station, very typical representation of the varied combination of peoples in Poland, cosmopolitan, peasants, religious Jews, the Orthodox. Now we've jumped to Warsaw, and the new field marshal, Edward Smigwy Ridge, or Edward Ridge Smigwy, depending on which you like. And along with the military display, the president of Poland is here, dignitaries. The Polish Cardinal Hlond, whose anti-Semitic pronouncements at the time fueled long-standing anti-Jewish attitudes among, this is Hlond here, among Polish Catholics. Again, the conversation that Brian Bucher and Carr had said that they felt a great deal of anti-Jewish feeling while they were there. There was a constant, now we're back in Krakow in the predominantly Jewish section. Carr said there was a constant and intense reference to the Jews hoarding gold, being extremely wealthy and evil, although Poland was obviously in no way a Nazi German country. On the Jews, they parroted the Germans word for word. They did not have very much difficulty filming. You see a few people hiding their faces, but in general, they were, you know, I don't think this, I think we vary between the main areas of Krakow, and then we will also see Kazimierz, the Jewish quarter, which is much more specific. Brian noted in this early 70s conversation that the shots of what he called the ghetto are remarkable historical material, and indeed they are remarkable. This is Kazimierz. That synagogue in the background, I believe, is still standing architecturally. This marketplace, Brian says, the ducks and the geese and the poultry were abundant, and that people were, you know, quite cooperative, and they got a lot of candid views. I love this. Now, I think you saw that scene in VHS, but I bet you didn't know it. We've only got a couple more minutes. We may or may not get to Nazi Germany. But this is the best. And he did the same in Warsaw.
I was going to say, we can just go let the real show, but just know that our break will be shorter. But we'll let it roll rather than shut the projector down.
Okay.
And people can
start
to take the break if they want.
Did you all hear that?
Yeah. We'll just let the whole reel run, but just know that we're hitting break time in just a couple of minutes. We won't steal the time from another panel. But so if you want to slip out here, but it's a shame not to let it roll since it's on the projector. So we'll just let this roll through with Ray's narration.
The scene that Roman Vishniak so famously photographed, many of you may recognize. We thought we might be seeing, are we seeing some Vishniak science films further along in the conference? And no, and these are some of the Jewish boys, the candid shots. Yeah, ask questions. We'll take anything. Time in Russia, yes? Okay, this is the Degenerate Art Exhibit in Munich in 1937. I'm going to guess the answer here. I'm sure he did. I don't know that we have a lot of specifics to tell you, but there's a certain amount of documenting. He also filmed folk dance festivals, puppetry everywhere. Yeah, this is so rare, wonderfully rare footage. Now, you're looking at a print that has this, what do we call it, wavy scribe, I call it hatch marks, something which, while it was living at Johnny Allen's, was probably created and marked so that it could not be used as a master, but it's so beautiful. These are Hitler Youth girls out for a walk. And one thing I want to get in from his Nazi Germany lecture and not miss out, even if I'm not specifically on the right topic, because you may or may not get to see the close-ups of Der Stürmer, Stryker's anti-Semitic newspaper. But Brian, in his lecture, and I find this absolutely remarkable. Oh, these are the Jewish benches in Berlin. Olivia Plots, which I don't place automatically, but this is where that close-up of the sign you saw earlier is placed.
Three blocks from the Berlin Zoo train station.
Really? Oh, thank you, Chris. Julian says, to my mind, in another 5 years, there will be very few of these 500,000 German Jews left alive. I think that's incredible.
When did he say that?
In 37, 38, wow. When he was lecturing. And that's not the only thing. You get to see his passport, which Sam has very kindly donated to the museum's collection. So we actually have the real thing. Unfortunately not. There's some exteriors of the anti-Bolshevik exhibit and lines of people standing, especially lots of SA men waiting to go in. Here we have Der Stürmer and the constant message that the Jews are our misfortune. And actually, sometimes they're pretty amusing. Here's a decadent Jewish weekend playing croquet. On the far right, the Jew Liechtenstein is the caption. So it's break time if you want to go, and we welcome you to stay. And if the lights need to come up a little, that's okay. This is the anti-Bolshevik exhibit. And now we're at Nuremberg Stadium for the Nazi Party rally in September 37. And look how close he is to Hitler. And best of my understanding, Julian filmed all of this himself. I believe that that's correct. And he's also very close to Himmler in a later scene. And some of the things that he had to say about this, well, obviously, the says it makes our football games look like small stuff. Here in the stadium at Nuremberg, 250,000 when they're standing up, and 50,000 are performing on the field today at one time. Hitler arrives with his entourage, and then he goes on to say, well, you can call him a house painter and make all sorts of cracks. The trouble is he's in power, and he's running things in Europe today, whether you like it or not. Most of what we see in this particular scene, not this one, but the men on the field with the spades, are the Reich Labor Corps, a paramilitary, basically, organization that accomplished lots of work building construction projects, but also had the men trained and ready to go straight into the army. And I believe the Labor Corps was required of a certain young male age group. Here's Hitler in the car taking the salute. And one of the things that Brian was very concerned about when he gave the lecture was actually that in the United States, anti-German feeling would swell to such an extent that we would be guilty of the same kind of bias and prejudice, and he truly recognized the danger of that in terms of democracy and the threat of fascism. And he urged his audiences to look around, the American audiences. Isn't this a wonderful German audience? He's right in there. And I'm going to tell you, these SS men in the black uniforms, I hope we're soon going to see Himmler coming up a staircase flanked by SS troops. And a shot that's not in this cut, or not in this reel, so I couldn't include it, is a camera pan down the back of the bleachers, presumably where these people are sitting. And from the silhouette of the people on the top, you come down to the concessions at the bottom, and they're lined up in three in a row, labeled postcards, souvenirs, anti-Semitic books. Now, Raymond Fielding's book on the March of Time claims that the way Brian got access to this, and we'll see, I know Sam disputes certainly a fair amount of what Fielding says in the chapter on Inside Nazi Germany. We'll see Himmler coming up here in a second. Fielding does say that the way Julian got access was the previous year he was at an embassy party in Turkey, and a Gestapo officer was complaining that American news coverage wasn't fair to Germany. And Julian said, well, how do you expect if you don't, you know, if you keep everybody out, how's it going to be reasonable? And he said, do you think you could arrange to get me in? And if that's true, it certainly helps to understand how it is he got the relatively unfettered access that he seems to have had. Well, we make ours available to consumers of historical footage, as we do Anything in the museum that is, I mean, depending on the rights restrictions, this is a mixed set of public domain material and Sam's material.
But anybody
can use it. He's very reasonable. And now we're just at the sort of coda back in Warsaw, the fires, the Jewish section of Warsaw burning as filmed by Julian. And this on in Rosh Hashanah, the period of Rosh Hashanah. There's only about 6 minutes left to the break. Yeah, things that are not true. However, though a few of them are part of a very interesting further collection of 4x6 glass slides, hand-colored, that Julian had created in New York, I believe in 1940, and which take many of the black and white images and convey them in another way. This is still Warsaw, yes. These are the outtakes from Siege. Although I was saying to Regina as we watched Siege, you know, I almost think we could recreate most of it from the 35 millimeter material we have. We have almost everything in unedited version. So an eye match job for Russ's folks. Here's Julian talking with some of the Warsaw residents. Sure, go right ahead. Everybody can do what they want. It's almost completely over. But you can see why we feel so passionate about this and why we hope that everything he filmed is well taken care of and finds good hands.